Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, brought to you by the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier in Orange, Virginia. My name is Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Whoa, wait a minute. There's something strange going on here, something different. That wasn't the same introduction I've been giving for over a year at WETS. What could be going on? Why do we have a new introduction? Well, we have a new introduction today because we have a new partner. And as you might have guessed, our new partner is, in fact, the home, the historic home, Montpelier. Montpelier, owned by James Madison. It was where James Madison was born, where he lived, where he died, and for our purposes, most significantly, where he thought up most of the good stuff in the United States Constitution. So we embark now upon a partnership that should enhance the missions of both of these august bodies, if I may include WETS along with Montpelier. Both of us are dedicated to the mission of public education, and specifically through this show, to the idea of constitutional and civic education. As you already know, if you're a regular listener, we've been working with Montpelier for pretty much our entire existence through the person of Kelly Carmichael, who works for the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, and she comes on just about every week and serves as our quiz lady. But during one of my many conversations with Kelly, and even more so during a series of visits out to Montpelier over the last few months, it just occurred to all of us, it seems independently, I don't even remember who came up with the idea, but we just sort of reached a consensus. You know, we really all should work together because we're working, generally speaking, toward exactly the same goals. And so that is what Your Weekly Constitutional is going to morph into over the next few weeks. It's going to morph into a radio show that brings you added features that you can only get at James Madison's Montpelier, things like the Madison Minute, where we're going to talk specifically about James Madison, the interesting facts in his life, members of his family like Dolly Madison, his important constitutional thought, his political, all kinds of stuff having to do with James Madison, the father of the Constitution. We're also going to have a regular feature called This Week at Montpelier, where we're going to talk about the fascinating goings-on there, the special programs, the tours, the highlights, even the ongoing work of research and education that happens there every week. So we're going to really step it up. We're going to make our show even more than it's been. But of course, we'll always preserve the core of it. We're always going to take at least one major constitutional topic each week. We're going to have interviews. If it's a controversial subject, we're going to try to get all sides. So this is what you might consider your weekly constitutional version 2.0, the James Madison's Montpelier version. I know you're going to love it. And where more appropriately to start this episode, and where more appropriately to focus it than on our own quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, who came all the way out to Johnson City from the Center for the Constitution, and who's going to tell us all about it. Well, if there's one question we get more frequently than any question at your weekly constitutional, and we do get a lot of questions. We get questions about the Constitution, suggestions for stories. We get, you know, all sorts of things. If there's one we get more than anything else, it's who is the quiz lady? Who is this mysterious lady of knowledge that comes in and quizzes all of our contestants? Everybody wants to know, who is Kelly Carmichael and why is she at the Center for the Constitution? So I have her here with me, and she is going to tell us all about herself. So Kelly, tell us what you do.
Yeah, well, I do just about everything. I feel like I have my hands on just about everything. I'm the Director of Civic Education at the Center for the Constitution, and I started there in 2008 and had at that point, prior to that, had been working at a Close-Up Foundation, which is a civic education organization in the D.C. area that brings students to Washington, D.C., and it's a nonpartisan program that educates students about government. And when I left there, I was managing the teacher program and professional development for educators, and this position became open at the Center for the Constitution. And I was really curious. And I was curious because I actually had done a weekend seminar at the Center for the Constitution in our constitutional villages, where we have folks who come and study and immerse.
So you were actually a person who came to a seminar there.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I just fell in love with the place. It really, really is quite beautiful. You mm-hmm. know, we joke on the show about it being a squirrel's leap from heaven. And
it's true.
It is funny to say that, but it really is. On some days, it's, you know, you pinch yourself that you get to work in the most gorgeous place, I think.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, so that's interesting. So civic education is a long-standing interest of yours, I
yes.
take it.
Yep.
And you had worked elsewhere and you came to Montpelier. Let's back up a little bit. What exactly is the Center for the Constitution? How does it fit into this historic estate we
sure.
call Montpelier?
Yeah, the Center for the Constitution is a department that's part of the Montpelier Foundation, or almost its own organization mm-hmm. that's part of the Montpelier Foundation. But we are a department of Montpelier. And we've been around since 2002.
This is your 10-year anniversary this year.
10-year anniversary, yep, mm-hmm. doing programs. We first started off in 2002 with the purpose of doing programs for educators to come to Montpelier, immerse themselves into the study of the principle and history of our Constitution and Bill of Rights, really high-level content on the Constitution, and then allow our educators to have time to discuss on how they may take this knowledge back to the classroom. We're strictly nonpartisan, and since 2002, we continue to do all of our work with educators, but we've expanded our audiences, and we now have had members, elected officials, members of the Virginia General Assembly come and study with us. We've had judges. We've had law enforcement officers.
Well, this is wonderful. So you're actually a place where people can go and not just take classes, that's certainly part of it,
yep.
but then take the time to discuss this and discuss it with their classmates and with other people,
yeah.
other teachers, and then you said even judges and politicians and people are coming to talk about the Constitution?
We'd like to call them audiences that have a leveraging point within society, or groups that, you know, on a daily basis are going to work with so many folks or work with the Constitution. A teacher who has to teach the Constitution, if mm-hmm. they're a social studies teacher, or everyone has to teach a Constitution on Constitution Day. You know, we want to give our teachers as much high-level content on the Constitution. They may not be able to use all of that content, especially if they're teaching, you know, fourth grade or fifth grade,
mm-hmm.
but they have the knowledge, because by having that knowledge, content knowledge, is going to make them that better.
Oh, absolutely. You know, even if you're not going over everything in class, I think that informs the level of instruction you're able to give. So that's never wasted. But what a great concept. And,
yeah.
and how big are these classes that come?
Well, we have 5 renovated farm homes right on James and Dolly Madison's property that we use. And for any given seminar, we can house up to 38 people. So I would
say, on average, people get to come there and stay.
So you talk about immersing yourself. You get to come to Orange, Virginia, and you get to stay in homes that are a 5-minute walk from the mansion itself. So in addition to studying the Constitution, you really are steps away from this really gorgeous, gorgeous house and gorgeous views of the Blue Ridge Mountains. So in the evening time, once, you know, formal class is over, oftentimes our visitors who are part of our programs will go and sit on James and Dolly Madison's steps and enjoy the sunset. Sometimes a, you know, glass of vino, wine will be with you.
Oh,
it's
man.
quite enjoyable. And up until, I guess, a couple of months ago, we didn't have any cell phone service and we had no TVs. So up until we didn't have cell phone service, you really had to immerse yourself.
You know, I know it wouldn't go over well, but I'm almost sorry to hear that you now do have cell phone
yeah.
service, because it's the very
it's
idea of retreating,
thing.
You know, the idea of
yeah.
going back there and thinking and getting away from that. So I hope some of those people will turn their cell phones
yeah.
off while they're there. But even the farmhouses themselves, now I've been in them, they're beautifully restored.
Mm-hmm.
And though you'll have a private bedroom, you have common areas and your kitchen areas
yep.
and a fireplace I saw in one of them. And so there are lots of places to gather, not just in the center itself, but
mm-hmm.
in these houses and around so people can talk.
Yeah, and it's worth going to center.montpelier.org because in addition to the audiences I've mentioned, we do every once in a while do programs for the general public, or we open up some of our programs for educators for anybody to apply to.
And that's how you do it. You just go to the center.montpelier.org.
And you can look and find out more information about how that process works. This recently we did a partnership program with the South African embassy and had a conversation between James Madison and Nelson Mandela and looked at the United States Constitution and the South African Constitution. And that program was open to really anybody who wanted to come.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a really rewarding program.
And how long do these programs last typically?
Usually our programs are 2 to 3 evenings. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes we just have a program that's one evening, or we've done plenty of retreats for, organizations, nonprofits that, want to do a retreat, want to explore the Constitution, but also use it as a place for meeting and having discussions about strategic planning and stuff.
Okay. Now, how do you fit into that then? If that's what the center does, how do you do that? What do you do there?
I do a number of different things. I run Virginia and Washington, D.C.'s We the People program, which is an extension of what we do with educators. It really is the top program to educate students at the high school and middle school levels about our Constitution and get them to first learn the principles, but then practice these important principles by doing a simulated congressional hearing competition format where the students have to answer a question about the Constitution.
Yeah, and regular listeners to this show will know what a big supporter I am of We the People. In fact, there are a couple of podcasts we have, both the Virginia State Finals and the National
Those
Finals.
Were
Those were great, great
Those were
times. And so there's lots about that, and that's an obvious extension of this. That's a huge commitment of your time, especially, I'm guessing, in the winter and spring.
Yeah, it's pretty busy. But in addition to that, we also have been really moving into the online learning environment. So in September of 2011, we launched our first online course called Constitutional Foundations. And I was heavily involved in the creation of that course. It's a free self-paced course. So if anybody wants to learn more about the Constitution, or, we stump you on some of these constitutional quizzes, some of the quizzes that we use on the show, we've pulled from that constitutional course quiz.
Oh, okay.
And
so
the content, there's much more content that explains some of these important principles.
I have actually gone on, and I haven't worked all the way through that program yet, but I have worked through several of the lessons. And I can tell you that every time I get online and do it, I learn something else.
Yep.
New and from a different perspective. It's interactive. It has, you actually take quizzes and you do questions. There are video presentations, very high quality, very well-produced stuff at Montpelier with a variety of different experts talking. And then, of course, there's written material and there's source material and there's lots of graphical material as well. It's very high quality stuff, and you can come to it and leave it as you need to, as you have time for it. And then you can take a test at the end of each segment. So it's wonderful.
A not graded test, by the way.
Not graded. That's entirely for your own benefit and to let you know what you picked up and what you haven't.
Yeah, and we're in the middle of working on the Bill of Rights course that we're going to be launching this summer, and then hopefully a course on citizenship this coming fall. So I'm heavily involved in the drafting and working with our scholars that are working on this course right now. So that will keep me very busy.
I'm sure it will. And we can't leave this without saying there's another new online feature you just, your colleague Jen Howell, has worked on, called Context, right?
Yeah, Context.
Now, I'm going to talk to Jen about that directly, but just briefly, what is that as well?
It is this new, unique crowdsourcing tool that takes James Madison's notes of debates of the Federal Convention and very long, very dense document and makes it very approachable. Because now folks, based on every paragraph, can search for important points that were mentioned during the Philadelphia Convention. They can tag information on historical points based on what was mentioned at the Philadelphia Convention. They can tag current issues. It's very, very, very exciting.
That's very valuable, and that'd be very valuable for scholars, too.
Yep.
Because I have a copy of that, and the Madison's notes in the convention they're not definitive. I mean, other people have notes as well, but his are the most complete, and they're the primary source of what happened at the convention. They're remarkable and extremely important, but they're hard to access for a lot of people in their original form. So that's very exciting for people like me who want to go and find something relevant in there quickly for their research. And it's, of course, relevant and important for everyone who's interested in that. So that's exciting as well. But anything else about what you do on a daily basis? Is your office right there at the center?
My office is right there at the center. It's a great place to come visit, come learn, come experience. So if anybody wants to come down and visit us, come visit us in the Constitutional Village, we'd be happy to say hello.
Come on down to Montpelier and ask for Kelly. Thanks very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, wasn't that great? I just love talking to Kelly, and it was a real pleasure having her here in the studio. We took a picture. We took a picture of Wayne and me and Kelly all in the studio, and we're all smiling. It's been up on the Facebook page for quite a while. It'll probably be there a while longer. And this seems to me as good a place as any for us to introduce our inaugural Madison Minute.
James Madison is called the father of the Constitution because he did more than any other person to create our revolutionary form of government. He was among the first to arrive in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and that was only after he had spent 6 months studying and preparing his ideas. These ideas became the Virginia Plan, the basic framework for the Constitution. Madison served as secretary to the convention. He attended every session and took the most comprehensive notes of the debates. The ideas which framed the U.S. Constitution are the culmination of centuries worth of thinking by great minds around the world. Madison's genius lay in putting these ideas together. For example, the U.S. Constitution was the first trial of the idea of separating a government into three distinct branches. Though often written about by political theorists like Montesquieu, the idea had never been put into practice, but Madison and his colleagues turned theory into reality. By giving each branch of government the power to check and balance another, they ensured that no single branch could become too powerful. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And that was our first Madison Minute. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks very much to Jim Blaylock of WETS, who's helping out with the Madison Minutes. Next, we're going to go and talk to John Jeans, who is the fellow in charge of the restoration of the mansion at Montpelier. His actual title is the Director of Facilities and Restoration. And he's a fascinating fellow. If you're a regular listener, you've heard him on two programs thus far. And this is actually a continuation of my very lengthy and detailed walkthrough of the mansion with John Jeans. It was a fascinating journey, and I know you're going to enjoy it. We're going to pick up on that now in the antechamber right next to the main dining room in Madison's mansion at Montpelier.
Actually, I should mention this,
sure,
which is a very key point about this space. We have so many visitor accounts that discuss Madison in his elder years, in somewhere between 1830 and when he passed away in 1836, where his rheumatoid arthritis was so severe that he had difficulty coming to the table, and yet his mind was as sharp as ever. Visitors accounted regularly how he would be in his study adjacent to the president's room, mm-hmm, and I'll open this door. This is a room that we are about to furnish over the next few months. He would be in here on a settee and communicating with everyone at the table, but taking his meal in this space.
Wow, he was affected by the arthritis.
Yes, it was very difficult for him. But the constant refrain was his mind was very sharp.
Well, it happens to all of us eventually if we're... We live long enough, yeah.
So here is a set of that paneling you can see more closely.
Right.
This particular paneling we found in a building. It was a bowling alley that was built in the 1800s.
Bowling alley in the 1800s.
Now, post-Madison, sometime possibly as early as 1850s. There are accounts of it in the 60s. But we're trying to back it down to the...
Now, John, I have to tell you honestly, I've never really thought about bowling alleys, but if you'd have asked me, I would have said a bowling alley, at least as we understand the term, is a 20th century phenomenon, but apparently not. Apparently they were around before that.
Yeah, you know, I think you got Rip Van Winkle and the bowling and so forth. You know, you hear of it in...
Well, I hear of lawn bowling. I didn't know people were building bowling alleys. Yeah.
And in the research, in trying to find more information about this, bowling alleys were sort of part on that list in the temperance world for... They were viewed negatively.
Like pool halls.
Because it was a place to gamble.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look back in the literature, you see a lot of response to bowling alleys based on the resistance and the condemnation of them.
Well, I can see that. It was a place for fun. We can't have that.
No.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking to some of our friends, or not just our friends, but our new partners at James Madison's Montpelier. Right now, we're talking to John Jeans, and we'll talk to him more in a minute. We've also been talking to our quiz lady, the beloved, the incomparable Kelly Carmichael.
Kelly, 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 Kelly. K-E-L-L-Y. Why? Because you're Kelly, 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 Kelly of mine. Mine, 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 mine.
Well, it's that favorite time of the show once again. Kelly is with us, the quiz lady from James Madison's Montpelier. How are you, Kelly?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing extremely well. Who do we have on the line today?
This is Nick Arms from Harriman, Tennessee.
From Harriman? Where is Harriman, Tennessee?
It's actually about 20 minutes west of Knoxville. It's a small town.
I see. 20 minutes west of... That's near Tellico, isn't it?
Actually, Tellico is a little more north of Knoxville.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Harriman is closer to Oak Ridge, if you know where that is.
Yes, yes, I do know where Oak Ridge is. You're not glowing at the moment, are you?
I don't think so.
Just glowing with happiness, but I'm talking about radioactivity here. No, okay. Yes, we know about Oak Ridge.
Our microphones are lighting up.
They actually are. They're lighting up on this Sunday. You got something going here. All right. Well, Kelly, what question do we have for Nick today?
All right, Nick, I have a question for you about the Bill of Rights.
Great.
All right, and here it is. The United States Bill of Rights, and I'm going to give you four choices, which you get to decide which one's correct. The United States Bill of Rights has A, always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuse of federal power. They have never been applied to what state governments can and cannot do. B, has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures. C, was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the Americans apply to state governments as well. Or D, was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions have applied some of the amendments to state powers as well.
Okay, well, those are very interesting choices. Why don't we go through them one at a time, and then Nick will ask you to say yay or nay as we go through it and tell us your reasons.
Okay.
What was A again?
A, the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuse of federal power. They have never been applied to what state governments can and cannot do.
Okay.
Okay, I think we can take A off.
How come?
Well, primarily because I'm thinking about the First Amendment right now, and I'm pretty sure it says no state shall.
Ah, okay, so you think some of the amendments actually say something about the states in them?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's a good reason not to just apply to the federal government.
If it's true.
Okay, so we'll cross an A off. Okay, what do we got? What's B, Kelly?
B, the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures.
I think the correct answer may be B, but let's table that and move on to C.
Ooh, let's table that.
I like table that. That's good.
He sounds very official there. Okay.
That's good. We'll have to bring him back.
Okay. Are you sure just for saying that?
C was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the amendments, I'm sorry, I may have misread that one to begin, was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the amendments apply to state governments as well.
And that one sounds good, too, primarily because I'm thinking, I know the 14th Amendment isn't in the Bill of Rights, but that applies some of the Bill of Rights to the states, I think. So let's move on to D and see if we can get D out of here as well.
D,
before we
okay.
go back.
Well, what's D?
D was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions have applied some of the amendments to state power as well.
Okay, let's cross off D as well.
Okay, we're crossing off D. Why are we crossing off D?
I can't tell you, actually. It doesn't sound good, I guess, would be my best answer for that.
So we're getting analytical here. It doesn't sound good.
Well, you know, right. When you're doing a paper or pencil test, you never select D if you're not exactly sure.
Oh, I thought you always selected
strategy,
D.
Strategy.
I thought when I was growing up, it was B or C.
We've got to use some of that strategy. All right, so what do you think it is then, Nick?
Can we hear B one more time, actually?
Sure. B has always been designed to protect individual rights from the abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures.
Okay. And what about C?
What about C, Kelly?
Was originally directed at the federal government, but recent court decisions have established that all of the amendments apply to state governments as well.
I'm
where it gets tricky because it has the all or the never, or the, you know, you have to play with the wording there.
And back to strategy, you know, it's all and never is
or some.
Usually not the right answer, it seems. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say B, actually.
You're going to go out on a limb and say B.
So he said that the United States Bill of Rights has always been designed to protect individual rights from abuses committed by both federal and state legislatures, and I believe he rationalized because Amendment 1 says states, the First Amendment protects states from protecting our rights.
Okay. You going to stick with B then, Nick?
I think so, yes.
Kelly?
Nick, you should have gone with your rationale and not go with the alls or nevers. It was D. It was originally directed only at the federal government, but recent court decisions, and here's the key word, recent court decisions applied some of the amendments to state power as well.
Great.
All the
same. I was way off.
No, well, kind of. You missed it, but you know, that's okay. I think maybe what you got misled by is that the 14th Amendment does say no state shall. And it was one of the first amendments to actually say that. And that's a very important part of the 14th Amendment. But you also know the 14th Amendment is not part of the Bill of Rights. That's just the first 10. And actually, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law.
Yeah.
And okay. So that would have, if you'd remembered that, that would have given you your answer. And that's essentially what has happened. It was really between C and D.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the Bill of Rights very clearly started out as protecting us against this brand new federal government. People were afraid of it.
Absolutely.
People referred to the federal government sometimes as, in Hobbes's famous term, the Leviathan, the sea monster. It was such a huge, ominous presence that they had this Bill of Rights to protect themselves from it. And it was only later, in fact, much later, mostly during the 20th century, that those individual rights also protected us against individual states. Up through the 20th century, states were not restricted in what they could do by the Bill of Rights, and so that's been a very important development. But here's another little twist. Not every single part of the Bill of Rights has been, as we like to say, incorporated against the states. There are still several of them out there that, technically speaking, only apply to the federal government. Most notably, the Third Amendment.
can we give our friend Nick extra credit if he knows what the Third Amendment is?
What's the Third Amendment?
It's my
Nick?
Favorite and most obscure amendment.
Oh,
here's your chance, Nick.
Here's your redemption.
At the moment, you don't have a T-shirt, but you're going to get one if you can tell us what the Third Amendment says.
And it really has no
relevance
today.
The Third Amendment is the quartering of troops.
Rescue! This is the first time we've had a quiz rescue.
Redeemed myself. Just redeemed myself.
Right. The Third Amendment says that you can't. The government can't quarter troops in your house, which was, of course, a big issue during the Revolution or before it. Except during times of war, and Congress has to authorize it, and there are all sorts of requirements, and it simply hasn't come up. And no states actually tried to do it, and so we don't have a court case. It would be interesting if it ever did come up, if it would be applied against the states. But at the moment, that simply has never been decided.
Never been an issue, but it's definitely an amendment that's a kickback from the Declaration of Independence and all the grievances that Jefferson listed as a government should never do, and quartering of troops was certainly one of them.
No red coats in my house.
Coats.
That's right. All right. Well, Nick, thank you so much. That was a very fun quiz, and we appreciate your time.
Had a good time.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
Great. Thanks.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're continuing our tour of the mansion at Montpelier with John Jeans. You know, we're finding all sorts of surprising things, including a bowling alley.
However, this bowling alley, after 1901, the DuPonts put additions on two wings. So what initially had been a straight structure, a long, straight, narrow structure, ended up having two wings placed on it, almost in the form of a cross, if you look down in plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the roof on one side was sheathed with the paneling from here.
Hmm.
And again, those we could see the rise and run of the stair, and we could see what the paint history was and the exact width of the boards and so forth. Interestingly enough, in those wings, the what Jefferson referred to as the joist, which were the roof supports for the two wings, were reused over there when the DuPonts made their alterations on the house and added to it. They took away the roof that had been in place on the wings.
We know whether the DuPonts, I didn't mean to interrupt, but do we know whether the DuPonts were simply being frugal, or were they actually thinking, I wonder, that it'd be good to keep these things around in case this place is ever restored?
Well, I think that they were very smart about not wasting materials, and mm-hmm. they saw that this material was still useful, and they did not feel it prudent to discard it. And that clearly, by the fact that it was reused, that's the truth. So,
there's a reason that they're so rich, then. It's because they don't waste things.
Well,
now we know.
I think they were very smart about their usage of materials, and I'm very thankful that they took these huge, beautiful window frames, these double-hung windows, and rather than discarding them, they reused 10 of them.
Absolutely.
And they did the same with doors, partitions, moldings, the two beautiful arch doorways that grace the left and right of the main foyer as you enter.
Mm-hmm.
Were actually moved to other locations rather than discarded.
And that's great.
So in our research, we were able to determine exactly where they belong and bring them back to their original location. But we certainly wouldn't have had that liberty had they not been conserved in the first place, or reused, I should say. We're looking at a pantry here where the Dolly would have housed her fine china and so forth, which would have been used to set the table.
Okay, here's an alert for my wife. She always would do this whenever we go to a place like this. This is where all the china is, my dear. This is where all the silver is. And when you come and visit, you'll have to come and gawk at it. I think she'd enjoy this.
She would. I think she would appreciate the fine items that are on the shelves.
Oh, yes, yes. They're beautiful.
Now, this is the library we call the new library. We know from the conversations or the correspondence between Dinsmore and Madison that this was intended to be a library, and there are various visitor accounts that deem it as a library later on. But the interesting one for me is Dinsmore is saying, "Mr. Madison, I think we can put in windows on either side of the chimney. You will be able to have sufficient space for your books." And we know there are other cabinets that will end up being placed in here for books. And through those windows, you'll be able to see the temple and the alley to the temple.
Right. Now, the temple is people today might be tempted to call it something like a gazebo. It's reminiscent of that, though it's much grander. And it's the symbol now of Montpelier. It's often when people look at the website, etc. And that's visible right through these windows.
Exactly.
And that's how you knew it was this room.
Well, it seems to support that very clearly,
mm-hmm.
And we know the building account. He's talking about this room and those windows, so
mm-hmm.
it links them very nicely. And actually, the temple is a little more utilitarian than just a pretty little structure out there. It houses an ice house below, which there's a 28-foot deep recess below. In which Madison would collect ice from the ice pond, and they would be able to store their vegetables and have cold drinking material on
hand. Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought it was purely decorative.
No, it actually had a very useful purpose.
I see.
As well as being a beautiful icon.
It is. It is beautiful.
But you can see that our museum department is beginning to populate this space with maps that we knew were hung in the Madison period, with furnishings that were appropriate to the this particular space.
And that's over the fireplace there is a map of Virginia at that time, which of course included what we now call West Virginia. And it goes up and even some to Pennsylvania and Maryland.
That's correct.
Yeah, and the eye is really drawn to that. It's very detailed. In fact, I'd say the coastal regions are probably extremely accurate. And in fact, I think most of the rest of it looks pretty much like it does today. So that's a high quality map for that era.
And I would say that another thing would be interesting to point out is as you walk through the house and look down at the flooring, this is all original material,
mm-hmm.
Very high grade, tight grain heart pine, and we're very fortunate that it survives in such good shape.
It's in very good shape, and I should note that most of what we walk on, of course, is matting that I'm assuming is here to protect the floor.
Exactly.
Right, and but doesn't really detract that much because you still leave many areas open for people to see it. Now, heart of pine, I've understood, is very flammable, isn't it?
Oh, yes. The pitch in heart pine is extremely flammable.
So we're very, very lucky this house has never burned down in 200-plus years.
And there are a few areas where we note that fire has made its way into the either into a beam and been caught very early,
mm-hmm.
or maybe some boards in front of the dining room, for example. They had some charred marks on them as well, but fortunately, nothing.
Yeah, it's really astonishing to me that houses of this vintage, any of them survived, given that the illumination was by candle and given that the heating was all by fireplace, and they're everywhere. Every room, every significant room has a fireplace in it.
Yes.
That astonishes me, and I can see how from time to time there might have been a burst of sparks and some chars on the floor, and we're very lucky it hasn't burned down.
Well, an interesting thing to note is that in the wings, it's just becoming fashionable to put a kitchen in the
mm-hmm.
house. Usually there are outdoor kitchens, but in Madison's home here in the wings, below us, as we stand in the north wing, is Dolly's kitchen.
Oh, we're very lucky then. I mean, that was the source of many a house fire, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
The very first room in which we began our discussion on the south wing, Nellie's side of the house, that's her kitchen below.
Good heavens, we're very fortunate. Okay.
And there is an interesting feature, and that is as the joists that bear the flooring descend, they have ledger strips on them about 2 inches up from the bottom on either side, and boards are simply loosely placed on top of the ledger strips. They're turned at an angle, then dropped in, and on top of that, there's a clay mixture with lime. It's sort of like a mortar, only very little binder in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, closer to mud than it is to mortar. And that's stacked maybe 2 to 3 inches. And that was something that Jefferson had used at Monticello, at Poplar Forest. And I've seen it at a number of homes of this period where fire is an issue. That would give a longer burn time.
That was a fire break.
Yeah.
He put in a fireproof ceiling.
Yes.
It
gives about another half hour is what I understand. So if you happen to have a bedroom in this space,
mm-hmm.
or whatever you're doing, it gives you a little more time to be alerted to the possibility, a very real possibility.
Very real.
Of fire.
Thomas Jefferson saves the day. That's marvelous. A great innovation.
Yeah.
It might have saved this house.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking to John Jeans, the Director of Facilities and Restoration at James Madison's Montpelier. Well, Kelly Carmichael from the Center for the Constitution, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
This week at Montpelier is one of my, well, the two favorite times of the year at Montpelier. It is the wine festival at Montpelier.
And the other one is the beer festival?
Well, no, the hunt races that we have in the fall.
The hunt races. Well, we'll talk about that one later. What's this wine festival that's going on?
Yeah, Saturday and Sunday we have favorite tradition returns to Orange County. We have wine, Virginia wines, 20 of the Virginia's finest vineyards will come to the Father of the Constitution. So you can come tour the house and then come taste the wine.
Oh, that sounds absolutely wonderful. Where do they set it up? Where do they set the wines up?
Right in the center field, right around where the horse racing takes place.
Kind
of open grassy area.
Do they set up a tent or something out there?
Lots of little tents. Yeah.
Winery will have its own tent?
Each winery will have its own tent. You can come bring a picnic. Bring a picnic with your family, taste some wines, bring some cheese or crackers. And
do we know if Madison actually grew any wine grapes or did he actually do anything of that sort, or do we know?
He liked his Madeira and he liked his wine, but I'm not sure about growing grapes. I'll have to ask some of our historians on property.
My sense, without knowing much about this, is that grape growing for wine in Virginia is a relatively recent phenomenon, but maybe I'm just ignorant of it.
Jefferson definitely liked his wine, so.
Yeah, I don't know if he did, if he was a vintner as well. Okay, so that is coming up when again?
Coming up the week of May 5th, Saturday and Sunday of that particular week, and they'll be cooking with wine classes and live music and rides and entertainment for kids. So if you want to learn more, you can go to montpelier.org or go to montpelierwinefestival.com.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're going to finish our tour of the mansion at Montpelier, where James Madison was born, lived, and died.
What we're going to do is we're walking from the new library through a small room. This is where Madison's secretary would take notes from memoirs from a constitutional convention. And now we're stepping into the president's room, which was his study.
Mm-hmm.
This room is where he spent his latter years. In fact, this is the room in which he died.
Really? He died at his desk?
He died seated in a chair, I believe, very calmly. I don't know if you would like to hear the rendition of this. There is an audio of this. Let me see if I can get that. I hope this is the right one. And it'll be rather booming.
I was always with Mr. Madison till he died, and shipped him every other day for 16 years. For 6 months before his death, he was unable to walk, and spent most of his time reclined on a couch, but his mind was bright. And with his numerous visitors, he talked with as much animation and strength of voice as ever I heard him in his best days. I was present when he died. That morning, Suki brought him his breakfast as usual. He could not swallow. His niece, Mrs. Willis, said, "What is the matter, Uncle James?" "Nothing more than a change of mind, my dear." His head instantly dropped, and he ceased breathing as quietly as the snuff of a candle goes out.
And that is from the memoirs of Paul Madison's servant, Jennings, Paul Jennings.
Very interesting. Well, you know, when it's time to go, that's not a bad way to go. But I think I would have finished my breakfast first.
Okay. You'll note in this room, the process has begun hanging another map of the period that was known to be in here. This is the Joshua Fry, the Peter Jefferson map.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, it's resting on the wall, which has a rather brown finish.
Yeah, it looks sort of almost like marble or stone of some sort.
It's a special way that you would finish the plaster if it were to receive either wallpaper or the distemper paint outside.
Oh, because it's rougher. It provides more of an adhesion, is that it?
Well, I think if you consider, typically there'd be three coats. There would be a scratch coat that would go right on the lath or directly on the masonry, depending whether it's an interior frame wall or an exterior or interior masonry wall.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the first coat. The second coat would be a brown coat, which adheres to it, which is not quite as thick as the first coat. And then the third coat would be a white coat, which would be a very thin but fine texture, which would be used on the ceilings.
Right.
That, in fact, is used on that ceiling. However, if you could cut back on the labor and be somewhat more parsimonious and careful, you could get away with only two coats if your second coat was done more smoothly. And that's the case here. This will get a wallpaper, and it's, in fact, I believe it has already been made for us and will be installed shortly.
All right.
So that will induce you to come visit us again.
Oh, I'll be back. I will be back. This is an ongoing process. It's very exciting to see it all coming together.
And what I think we should do is walk up the period two stair.
Okay.
And if you note, the rise and run on this stair for a 1797 stair is quite gentle.
It is. It's very easy. The stairs are not very high, and they're very broad.
And it may be speculative for me to say this, but Dolly was experiencing problems with her knees early on. And I would venture to say that this is James's response to making that a little bit easier.
I think that would be a very reasonable speculation.
This is the best chamber. It's quite a beautiful bedroom. If you note, there's a door heading to the north, and you could step out through that door onto the terrace.
Oh, how nice.
And so if you look to the west, you can see the gorgeous Blue Ridge Mountains.
Oh, the views are spectacular here.
And that living space there is very much of a wonderful addition.
Now, we've moved into another room here, which is more like a small exhibition hall on the second floor. And I'm looking over here at a number of constitutional concepts written on the wall. So could you tell me about this room?
This was the old library. This was the original library that Madison's father housed his books in this area. And visitors mentioned that coming up the period one stair, the adjacent room and this space were completely packed with bookshelves and bookcases, tables with documents, etc., stacked as high as you could.
So it looks like a typical law professor's office. Most of my colleagues, that would describe most of their offices.
Yeah.
But you've made it into a small exhibition area, and there's a video screen on the wall there. So I'm guessing this is about the Constitution.
It is. And what the way the progress of the tour goes, you start on the first floor, and your guided tour ends at this point, and so this is the sort of the last, you go through to the terrace after this, and that's guided as well, but this is sort of the last message that you get, and they wanted it to be as powerful as it could be, because we're, you know, this entire restoration was based on bringing Madison back to the people, so that we could educate the public on this incredible intellect. And, you know, I whenever I stand in this space, it's often referred to as a space in which it's very likely that the Constitution was formed with the Virginia Plan initially in this space.
Right. Madison was probably sitting here, or not very far from here, when he was thinking through what he needed. And many of the concepts that he championed or even originated are written on the wall under several headings like federalism, separation of powers, etc. One of my favorite Madison quotes of all time is under the heading Man and Government, and it's from Federalist number 51. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. That really says it all. I mean, why do we even have government? It's because we need them.
Yeah.
We need them. All right. Tremendous. Well, on we go then.
This section of the house is the part of the original core, the 4 over 4.
Right.
And
Oh, and here you've got, you're exposing the various layers that you, this is basically a room devoted to the restoration, right?
Yeah, we call this the architectural room. Mm-hmm. This is a place where the public can step into a space that we intentionally left open to view the structural support systems, etc., so that they could see how a home of this period was constructed. And there, you know, everything from, there's a truss partition here, which was put in, it was a retrofit in that 1809, 1812 work.
Mm-hmm.
A weight-bearing wall was removed from the drawing room. And in order to support the floor systems, this particular type of structure was put in place. And so it's very instructive of building technique. And you can also see, we talked about plaster keys,
right,
how the plaster oozes through. Now, at the bottom of this...
Oh, we're looking at it. That's the plaster record right there.
Exactly. And this wall is... What you're looking at is only one half of the wall having been plastered. And you can see there's almost 3 inches of accumulated plaster,
right,
in the bottom.
Well, what we're looking at looks, again, to the untutored eye and using lay terminology, it looks like a bunch of beams. And then on top of the beams, in much of it, there are horizontal slats. I believe you call those the lath?
Correct.
Okay. And those horizontal slats then are the lattice work upon which this plaster is plastered. And then we are actually looking at part of it, we're looking at it from a reverse angle, and you can see where the plaster seeped through and then fell in the space between the walls to the ground, which is what John was talking about earlier, or to the base of it, to the wood base, and then forms these piles. And then these piles, they have various layers. And then archaeologists and restorers and architects can figure out what was in each of these layers. And the lower down you go, the older it is.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right. You can see in one place here, it says, can you find the ghost of the chair rail? Can mm-hmm. you find the chair rail ghost? And so if you look on the side of the trim, the architrave or the backband, you can see where this section of chair rail had once...
oh, yeah, you see the outline of it.
Intersected.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And so it gives the visitor... a concrete, tangible representation of how our researchers are able to distinguish what particular profile chair rail might have been here, even though it was taken out in the 1840s.
For heaven's sake.
And then one of the things that I like to do when I bring school groups in, for example, is we might be talking about... I'll say, you know, you'll see in this house both ghosts and dragons. And when you leave, if you're being honest with me, you will say, Mr. Jeans, I have seen ghosts and I have seen dragons. Well, we've just talked about a ghost.
Where's the dragon? I want to see the dragon now.
Well, are you satisfied?
I'm satisfied. Mr. Jeans, I have seen a ghost. Yes, I have. Okay.
Good. Well, in hip roofs of the period... the construction of the ceiling requires a particular beam that runs to the outside corners.
Mm-hmm.
And it is known as a dragon beam.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of a math lesson, too.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Georgian 4/4.
Right.
It had four outside corners, so how many dragons are in this house? There are
four.
You're going to be four.
Right.
Now, a very astute student might come in and look over here in this corner, knowing that there's another addition on there, and he might say, he may one-up me by saying, however, with that addition, you've added two more dragons.
Right, yeah.
So there's six dragons in this house.
I'm not very astute, but okay, I see your point. Yeah, and as you look up at the ceiling...
I don't think I gave you time to respond, and I would have done that.
No, but I see what you're saying, and I can see why they'd call it a dragon, because it does go across horizontally. And yeah, okay, very interesting.
And I guess another item might be, if you look in this display case, you mm-hmm. can see three items. One would be an old shingle, a 1797 period shingle. This will be heart pine.
Really heart pine, okay.
In this house, we found three types of shingles. Majority were heart pine, white oak, and then we had chestnut.
Hmm.
And what we have used for longevity's purposes, we've styled all the shingles as they were in the period, but we've actually used cypress because every time we have to engage with this house, there's a chance of doing some harm. So we want to minimize the impact on the exterior
sure.
by putting the very best product we can.
No, I understand completely. And in fact, I would say I've often heard it said that if the roof goes, the whole structure will go.
Yeah.
And you've got to keep the water out. And so, no, I understand exactly. you'd have to make a bit of a compromise with utility there, sure.
Now, there's a brick in this display, which is quite wonderful because someone carved in it the layout of columns just to give a sense of proportion, I think, in a discussion about what the house was going to look like. And
this is like a Rosetta Stone. This is almost like a blueprint carved into the side of a brick.
It is.
That is extremely cool.
So, and you know, to be able to work with this material and not let anything like that escape.
Yeah, I was just thinking, thank heaven whoever picked it up didn't just say, hey, here's another one for the pile. I love old houses, but I'll tell you what, I'm so glad you put it in the modern heat.
Well, what we do is we think of the house as the artifact, and so we're actually setting temperatures and humidity.
They'll preserve the artifact.
For the artifact
sure.
versus, you know, our visitor we think very highly of. We want them to be as comfortable as possible, but we also know that our job is really to keep this house in as good a shape for as long as we can, to sustain it. And, you know, that is our job to provide the public into, you know.
Right, and if you keep the humidity down and you keep the temperature closer to a, you know, a temperate level, it'll probably last a lot longer. Yep, you get a lot less mold and such.
So we're heading down the period one stair, and this is a good deal steeper, but it is very wide.
Uh-huh. Now these metal rails, were these original?
These railings are strictly for safety.
Yeah, I was thinking they didn't look very authentic. Okay.
Yeah, they are strictly for safety and what we, our study indicated that there were no railings in the initial house.
Oh, okay. Well, so, you've got to have those. Yeah, I understand that.
And that's the end of our tour of the mansion at Montpelier, James Madison's Montpelier, courtesy of John K. Jeans, the Director of Facilities and Restoration at that wonderful historical monument. Wasn't that fun? In fact, hasn't this entire episode been fun? This is our inaugural episode of our new format, our new partnership with the people at James Madison's Montpelier, our good friend Kelly, and of course John Jeans, and all the other wonderful people there that we'll be hearing from in the future. We tried out our first Madison Minute. We've had our first update of things that are going on at Montpelier, and you really do need to get out to Orange, Virginia, which is just north of Charlottesville, Virginia. Whenever you get a chance and visit Montpelier, if you hear about something like the Wine Tasting Festival or some of the excavations or the hunt race or the walks in the woods or the tours, any of the things at Montpelier, you need to get out there, especially if you find yourself anywhere near Charlottesville, because Orange is just, well, it's just a squirrel's leap from heaven, they like to say. I think that's all for today. I think that's our show. I'd like to thank Kelly Carmichael. I'd like to thank John K. Jeans. I'd like to thank our executive producer, Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it. Before we go, let me just remind you that, hey, we're very high-tech here at Your Weekly Constitutional, so just get online sometime and Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll pull up our Facebook page. You could be a fan.